because we'll need the requisite attention. The first item on our agenda, however, is the report that we had from the Department of Trade and Industry. on budget vote 22. That was on March the 14th. So there are rough minutes here that you can just go. I picked up one or two errors. So I would suggest that you commence with that and then dispose of this so that you can immediately deal with the main order of the day. So if we can look at the minutes for this report, which was circulated to members. If we can look at page 1. I would like to immediately point out the fourth paragraph. There's a sentence that reads, in trying to remedy this, the GTI introduced policy and strategy such as GTA. And my understanding that that's not correct, as GTA was not introduced primarily by the GTI, the government initiative. So I'm not sure about the accuracy of that. You'll have to check for the correct formulation of that. If there's nothing more on page 1, I would like us to go to page 2. On page 2, the middle of the page, there's a point that commences with consumer law reform has seen the new consumer protection bill subjected to 12 months of consultation and amendment to reflect public input and will be reverted to cabinet in March 2007. I think we could do with a better formulation there. The grammar or something doesn't read correctly. And then, in my view, another inaccuracy. The second last arrow point there, the one that commences with international trade and investment has led to the contribution to the January 2007 resumption of the WTO go-around doesn't make sense at all. So we either delete that or find out what the department was saying there. But international trade and investment did not lead to the resumption of the Doha round of talks. More controversial than that. So let's look at that and correct that. Is there anybody else who would like to make a comment on something on page 2? Could we then go to page 3? Page 3, just a few typographical errors, apostrophes and what have you, but I'll give that to the committee clerk. If there's nothing further, members, then I would like us to go back to the main order of the day. So we go back to corporate law. We are in your Excellency. The last time we stopped at chapter 5, if memory serves me correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson and honorable members. I want to greet you once more. And today, our program will start from our presentation of chapter 5. And given time constraints, we are going to be emphasizing the salient points from the bill. And if there are any questions in regard to other points which are not classified here, we will be happy to address them. If not in this forum, maybe in another forum. But be that as it may, I would like to start by saying that the policy of government insofar as the takeovers and offers and fundamental transactions was concerned was to attempt to treat all fundamental transactions in a manner that would give value to the shareholders and to try to reform the Securities Regulation Panel, which is the panel that is currently regulating the takeovers and offers and fundamental transactions, and to transform it and re-establish it under the name Takeover Regulation Panel. Now, what you will see from Chapter 5 is that the Companies Bill basically retains the existing schemes to a large extent. Particularly the scheme that is provided for in Section 440 of the Companies Act. And the main changes really under the takeover offers and fundamental transactions concern the introduction of the need for the notification of share purchases in excess of 5% in a widely held company. What the bill requires is that every time an offeror acquires 5% or more of the shares of securities of a company that is widely held, then that company should be able to notify the commission also and the takeover regulation panel of such acquisition, and also the intention with regard to the increase in the acquisition as to whether it is aimed at a takeover or is just an incidental acquisition. The second point that we need to make is that the approval of fundamental transactions, I think it's provided for in Section 119 of this bill, has been transformed quite dramatically. Fundamental transactions, by the way, refer to the disposal of substantially all the assets of the or undertaking of the company, a scheme of arrangement, or a merger or amalgamation. Now, as you may be aware, under the current legislation, Companies Act, there is no self-standing merger or amalgamation provision to start with. And secondly, business combinations were undertaken through a Section 311 scheme of arrangement. But what has happened is that the bill is now introducing an easy-to-follow process of merger and amalgamation, and it's subjecting this together with the scheme of arrangement and the sale of substantially all assets to the same requirements, particularly in relation to the majority required for approval. Now, what the bill provides is that the quorum for the approval of such a transaction will be 25% of the votes of the shareholders, and in addition to that, more than 50% of the quorum should be able to approve such a fundamental transaction, and that such a transaction need not be approved by the court unless there is a significant minority which is opposed to such a transaction, or there is procedural irregularity or a manifestly unfair result is found or alleged and can be found by the court. Under such circumstances, then the court should be approached. As you may be aware, the current Section 311 dealing with schemes of arrangement basically requires court intervention at all times for the approval of such transactions. But it has been, our research has revealed that to a large extent such a transaction need not go through the court if the shareholders of a company, a significant number of the shareholders of the company, are in agreement and support such transactions. And therefore, that is why the bill now provides that where there's at least 15% of the shareholders who are opposed to that transaction, or there's a procedural irregularity or a manifestly unfair result, then such a transaction must be subjected to court approval. But under any circumstances, such transactions should be able to be approved by the shareholders of the company. Now, you will realize that the bill also introduces the appraisal remedy for dissenting minority shareholders. That is, the remedy to have their shares appraised and bought at a fair price by the company where the shareholders are opposed to the transaction, but the transaction nevertheless is approved and it goes ahead. And most importantly, the bill introduces, as I've already pointed out, the self-standing concept of merger and amalgamation of companies. Now, it has been questioned as to if we do away with the court approval for fundamental transactions, how would you ensure that there is protection of creditors? Because the court intervention was mainly for the purpose of ensuring that creditors are protected in such a scheme. Now, you would see that the bill provides that the transaction must be such that upon its completion, the company will still be able to satisfy the solvency and liquidity test that we discussed it last week and as defined under Section 4 of the company's bill. And the solvency and liquidity test is mainly there to ensure protection of creditors in any transaction, including the fundamental transaction, and also particularly for the distribution. In the absence of any person,
yeah, I'll try not to take time. I gave our colleague a paper clipping this morning from Business Report, I think from yesterday, about Arveng. There's something going on there. I think it's a merger and acquisition, although I don't understand what's going on. But the point is that very often the arrangements companies make are so complex. The merger and amalgamation thing is so complex, and sometimes you think it's deliberately so, that the small shareholder, the minority shareholder or person, doesn't really know what's going on. Is there any way that the maybe it's impossible, but is there any way that the legislation can require that a particular merger and amalgamation is set out in a way that the minority shareholder, maybe it might only be a few people, understand what the intention is and what the implication is? Because I would hope that in the case that I've just passed on, that an ordinary shareholder wouldn't understand at all. So that's my first point. But secondly, we did indicate we would like a sort of set, a definition of different kinds of shares. Remember, we were promised some sort of explanation of what kind of shares, options and all that. It would be useful if we can get an indication when we might expect that. Thanks.
Thank you, honorable member. The first question relating to the clarification of this kind of transaction. The role is basically that of the takeover regulation panel. And the takeover regulation panel, as the main custodian of the shareholder rights in such transactions, is under an obligation to give clarity on any transaction where the shareholder is not satisfied or it does not understand the implications of the transaction. And therefore, the reformed takeover regulation panel will have that role of clarifying any transaction and its consequences to the shareholders. And the shareholders will be at ease either to approach the company's ombuds or the takeover regulation panel where they feel they are dissatisfied and needs more understanding, so that they can even give effect to any of their rights, particularly the appraisal rights, if they want to dissent to any proposal that has been made. And therefore, the informal process that is undertaken through the takeover regulation panel will be very critical in ensuring that transactions are made clearer to any shareholder in a company. And this, it must be understood, applies to widely held companies. And the second question relating to the financial terms, shares, debentures, and options. My colleague, Mr. Mpianele Baku, is busy with that. I phoned him this morning to find out as to whether he is ready to deliver the document, and he said that he is not ready, but he will give it to me tomorrow, and then I will have a look at it, and once I am satisfied, and I will then forward it to the committee. I should be able to do this by Friday, and I don't know when will it then reach the committee. I'll give it to the Roy.
Okay. You can continue.
Thank you. Now, Chapter 6. Chapter 6 is one of the most important innovations of this bill, and it deals with business rescue. And we have been approached to change this name to corporate rescue rather than business rescue, and the reasons that have been given were that since this applies only to companies that are registered in terms of the company's bill, then it would be inappropriate to refer to it as business rescue as if it refers to all types of business entities. But whether you call it business rescue or corporate rescue, the fact remains that it applies for companies that are registered in terms of the Companies Act, and it replaces the current judicial management regime, which is in the Companies Act, particularly Section 427. And maybe to give a little bit of a background to judicial management. Judicial management was a process that was court-driven, or let's say it's court-driven. The court is approached where the company is insolvent or is imminently reaching insolvency. And any of the interested parties, which could be the liquidator, the creditor, or the shareholder, can be able to approach the court to make an application for judicial management of the company. And judicial management really means a process whereby the court appoints a judicial manager for the purpose of replacing the management of the company and turning the business of the company around. And usually you have to show the probability of profitability of the company upon the appointment of the judicial manager. The process happens in two stages. At first stage, the court will give a provisional judicial management order, and it will have a return date, what you call a rule 9-5, to say that on this particular date, the court will confirm the appointment of the judicial manager unless any interested party will object to such a final appointment. And during the time that there's a provisional management, judicial manager, investigation is taken into the affairs of the company, and where the judicial manager has prepared a report. It goes to court on the return day, and it is discussed in court, or its conclusions are discussed in court, and the court makes a final decision as to whether to confirm the appointment of the judicial manager. And the judicial manager will in fact take over the management of the company, and the sole purpose is to trade the company out of insolvency or out of imminent insolvency. And the process has been a drastic failure ever since it was introduced in the South African company legislation in 1926, particularly because of a number of reasons that have been leveled against it. One of the reasons is that it is usually too late for the company to be rescued or to be saved when the judicial manager is appointed, because the requirement there is that the company should be insolvent or should be in the process of going into insolvency, and as such it is usually very late. Therefore you need a process prior to that where an early warning light could actually enable the process for turning the business of the company around for the purpose of saving the company to the benefit of the shareholders, the creditors, and all the employees of the company. Now that is what the business rescue model attempts to do, and the business rescue model is basically largely self-administered by the company and is under the independent supervision with constraints set out in this chapter, and is subject to court intervention at any time on application of any stakeholders who are referred to as affected persons, and the definition of affected persons is given in the chapter. Now, what do we mean by the process being largely self-administered? You will realize that the company's bill does no longer leave the business rescue regime to the court. The company's bill provides that the company itself, either through the board of directors or shareholders, can be able to pass an ordinary resolution. And this ordinary resolution will be to the effect that the company requires business rescue, and as such a resolution is made for the company to be rescued. And there are many consequences that follow from such a resolution, and it is as effective as any court order that could be given for the purposes of a business rescue. And the main consideration is that upon consideration of the financial statements of the company by the company itself, which usually will have intimate information about its own financial situation, then it should be easy for it to enter into a business rescue model. This is mainly a shift that has been made by the bill from a more creditor-oriented business rescue regime through the judicial management process to a more debtor-friendly system, where the court plays a central role in determining its turnaround strategies. And we need to have regard to the fact that such a resolution that is passed by the company or by the board of directors or by the shareholders is subject to an objection by the affected parties. And affected parties include shareholders who are not party to the passing of the resolution, the creditors of the company, and also employees of the company. They may be able to approach the court to object to such a resolution. In order to ensure that there is no abuse of the system of passing resolutions for business rescue, this mechanism will be very important in the future. And also in order to ensure that there are no frivolous actions by the affected parties in objection to resolutions, the bill makes it clear that such an objection should be followed or accompanied by evidence to the effect that there is no probability that the company can be rescued or that the supervisor who has been appointed for the purpose of effecting this business rescue does not meet any of the qualifications that are specified in terms of the act and outlined in the regulations. Now, those are basically the first step of being largely self-administered, and also the check on the self-administration process by objecting to the company resolution. Then the process of court engagement is also retained, in the sense that where the company has not passed any resolution, and any of the affected parties is of the view that the company is basically fast approaching insolvency, and as such it needs to be rescued, any of the affected parties can be able to approach the court and on evidence prove that business rescue would be the most advantageous method rather than liquidation, because usually liquidation usually the result of liquidation is that it benefits only a few stakeholders in the process, and the people who are actually very much benefited by the liquidation are in the first place the liquidator himself or herself, and the creditors of the company, and to a large extent the company will not be able to continue in business after the liquidation, and as such it is important that a shift from the creditor-based business rescue regime to a more debtor-friendly one must be recognized by the legislation. And that is why, in addition to that, the bill recognizes the interests of shareholders, creditors, and employees, and provides for their respective participation in the development and approval of a business rescue plan. Basically, what happens is that the shareholders will have their meeting, and creditors will have their committee and meetings, and so will employees have their committees and meetings, at which they will be pointing and raising out ideas in respect of the business rescue plan. The process is that once the business rescue is commenced, either through the company's resolution or through the court order, there must be an appointment of a supervisor. A supervisor should be an independent person who will be responsible for supervising management of the company for the purpose of turning the company around. And this supervisor will basically work together with management for the purposes of developing a business rescue plan. But it is mainly the responsibility of the supervisor to develop a business rescue plan, which must then be approved by independent creditors of the company. And the creditors include employees to the extent of their unpaid remuneration. And what is important about this chapter is that it protects the interests of employees in a number of ways. Firstly, by recognizing them as creditors of the company with a voting interest to the extent of any unpaid remuneration. Secondly, requiring consultation with them in the development of the business rescue plan, and permitting them an opportunity to address creditors before a vote on the plan, and according them as a group the right to buy out any dissenting creditor who has voted against approving a business rescue plan. I think that in brief is chapter 6. This is a new invention in terms of the company's bill. I think if we had the time, you know, I would be able to go deep into all the provisions, but at the moment I would just urge the members to look at it. And I just want to point out that the department is now proposing a workshop with many interested parties in this business rescue model, which will take place on the 9th of June, to look into the consequences of the business rescue plan. because we have received quite a number of lengthy comments on this chapter alone from interested parties, in particular the Banking Association, which is quite concerned that this is going to be a drastic move from the current status of creditor-based insolvency regime, and as such it requires proper consultation, and from the labor organization, COSATU, which feels that the rights of the shareholders, of the employees, need to be bolstered in the bill, and also from other very interested stakeholders, including the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. And therefore, we as the department have seen it very important that we should meet with this particular stakeholder so that we can be able to find out what their main concerns are and how we can be able to update this bill without doing injustice to the business, the functioning of businesses in South Africa for the benefit of all stakeholders involved.
Where's the workshop taking
place? The workshop, the logistics have been finalized now, but we are hoping that it will take place in Johannesburg. And it is the initiative of the department, although we are working together with the stakeholders that have already identified. And Mr. Chairperson, maybe what I should do is, once all the information has been confirmed, I will send through Saroj the confirmation of the venues and the participants to the committee, and if ever there's any one member of the committee would like to attend, then that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Ramakrishna. Could you kindly speak up?
I'm speaking to the last bullet about a group having the right to buy out a defending credit. I was voted against approving a rescue plan. I don't think I understand it very well. But again, Chairperson, I was wondering how possible it is for one to, you know, some of us are lay people, we don't understand much of these legal things, but perhaps if we could get a narration of the difference between the rescue plan and the current judicial management as to, you know, you know, just to say this is what it was and this is what now it will be. It will be more helpful. Thanks.
Thanks, Madam. I'm sure that's a reasonable request to do that for greater understanding for everyone. Comrade Farida Mohammed.
I think this is quite a good chapter because there have been tremendous amount of defaults with regard to members in a company, and the resolutions, you know, in terms of rescue plan, I think is a good thing. I just wanted to comment on your advocacy. I think you're going to be giving quite a bit of detail to the stakeholders, but I would urge the department to look at ordinary people as well, in terms of women particularly, you know, to find women's groups and also try to, you know, deconstruct all the myths that might be in their minds. It might be a good idea to work with the Women's League and others to actually get this advocacy going.
Thank you, Dr. Rabi.
Yeah, I'd like to support what the presenter said here. My experience is that most countries that have been placed under the, judicial management tends to flounder because the reason for that often is is that the judicial management are very good at legal matters and such, but they often lack business expertise and such, and that's one of the reasons why companies often flounder. But something else, you mentioned something that the banking fraternity has expressed concern. Now, Chairman, my experience is that the cost of capital, often you find that the companies that they really get it, they don't use their own capital, they don't. That seems to stifle growth in circles. With this, my only concern is, Chairman, is whether we like it or not, the banking fraternity is extremely important because they have to provide credit for many of these businesses and so forth. And I'd like to have them tell us what's their main concern. Why have they expressed concern regarding the what we call this new turnaround strategy? So I'd like to hear you in more detail. Thank you, Chairman.
Dr. Ivy, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Also, I would like to echo my admiration of this initiative or this inclusion. But one is always queried to the extent to which you get costs and the Department of Justice and the Constitutional Development being shouldered with this work. I used to frown at it before I came to Parliament, so what it has commended the initiative from my side as well. And just on that point, Chair, the question is then, wasn't there a legislative arrangement for the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development per se to actually handle the judicial management components? Or was it something that's in the shoulders of the court on this? I think it's because of the previous arrangements. If that has been addressed, then it's fine. The other question is with regards to the last bullet point, the right to buy out any dissenting creditor. Our workers as a group only going to be confined to buying out dissenting creditors only. Would they, if they are able to mobilize the capital, be able to go beyond just dissenting creditors, if possible? Thank
you. I think that we can take a response.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The first observation which was made regarding to the preparation of a clear summary of the current judicial management and the proposed business rescue that we can be able to do, Mr. Chairperson. I think it will take us, maybe we will be able to properly give you the response. I can say we can say a maximum of 2 weeks. We do have other commitments that are lined up in the next week that are quite certain, but we will ensure that within 2 weeks we have it. And the second issue involving involvement of other stakeholders.
That just before you go to the other issues. Obviously, as we deal with this legislation, if there's any other information that you come across that you might think would be of relevance or interest to assisting members of the portfolio committee with a broader understanding, you can always just send one copy to the committee clerk and then it will be replicated for the attention of all members. So that would also be appreciated.
No, that's fine, Mr.
Chairperson.
The second issue involving in other stakeholders in the process, I must point out that we are working within very limited time frame, and the bill was published, was approved by Cabinet for public comment on the 7th of February. this year, and it was published by the department and was gazetted on the 12th of February. And we had consultation processes actually from February until the beginning of April. And basically the consultation process did not actually end up then, because we still received many written submissions, and we also consulted with a number of stakeholders beyond that. And our deadlines for approaching government at the moment are set at August. Actually, by August we need to have the updated bill that we are going to present to cabinet for introduction into parliament. And therefore, we would be working within such limited time frames. And if possible, we would be amenable to any suggestions of the committee as to what are, who are those stakeholders that they have in mind, and what processes do they have in mind for consultation prior to the time that the bill has to be presented back at cabinet in August. But we are ready to listen to any other views. That if ever there are people that you would like us to invite for the workshop that is taking place in June, then we would be very helpful. That would be helpful to us. The third issue involves the banking fraternity, and that since they are, you know, the main contributor to the operating capital of the businesses in South Africa, what are their main concerns regarding that business rescue model? We realize that actually from the banking fraternity, we have received a number of comments. Some came from individual banks, like Standard Bank, and there was a united front which was presented through BUSA and also through the Banking Association. I think the Banking Association is by far the most voluminous paper that we have from the banking fraternity. And I can say, Mr. Chairperson, that many of their concerns relate mainly to the ease with which companies can be able to enter into a business rescue model. And given the consequences of business rescue, which are the moratorium on the moratorium on legal action against the company during the business rescue, and the fact that suppliers may be compelled to supply on the same terms and conditions during the business rescue, the banking fraternity thinks that this is going to increase the cost of capital very high, very much, and therefore they are concerned that there needs to be some amelioration of the mechanisms of entering into a business rescue, and the consideration of some tighter control over the process. Particularly the business, the Banking Association has mentioned that it is important that there should be a specialist tribunal or a specialist court that should be responsible for allowing any admission into business rescue regime, so that there should be an overriding supervisor, so that it cannot be abused. Otherwise, then the banks are going to lose out tremendously if ever the triggering mechanisms for business rescue are going to be made easy, and the cost of capital is going to go up very high, and it's going to go against business. Those are some, in brief, the main objections by the banking fraternity.
Just as a response to that, the concerns raised, they sound reasonable as you articulate them. Then I would be interested in what were the department's views to those. businesses to meet those challenges or balance the interests of all parties concerned. Just the rough ideas. I don't expect you to conclude all the issues finally, but just the understanding at present.
Because we received a number of other comments which are sort of contrary to the Banking Association submission as to the mechanisms for entering or triggering the business review, some of which even suggest that the mechanisms seem to be too complex and that we need to have a very simple mechanism of merely filing an intention to go into business review with the commission, and the commission should then be able to approve, which shouldn't even require any sort of resolution by the directors or the resolution by the shareholders. We find ourselves in a situation where we want all these parties to come together and be able to stretch out all their ideas and all their views, so that before we finalize any conclusion and we finalize the chapter, we would have had all these opposing views, particularly in view of the fact that on the one hand, you have got a group that thinks that the mechanism for entering business rescue is quite strict. On the other hand, you have others who say that it's too easy and it's going to increase the cost of capital. Therefore, I think to take a haphazard conclusion will be quite unreasonable on behalf of the department. That is why we are hoping that at this workshop, where we will be stretching out these issues, we will be able to find out exactly what position to take, and we will be able to finalize the chapter afterwards.
Just
on the face of it, from a parliamentary point of view, the idea of rescue is much better than liquidation, on the face of it. What of course, the formula I would like to suggest is that the bill should favour rescue subject to the interests of the creditors. Obviously, you don't want to leave the banks out because they are defending the creditors. But, you know, this business of quick liquidation is a bad route, whereas rescue is a good route. So the formula I would favour is a rescue is a more desirable option, subject to safeguarding the interests of the banks. Something like that.
Sorry, I'll add my stuff.
Thanks. I will call the guy to your bank manager.
Just one question. I'm just interested in knowing how this deal relates to the Competition Commission. Is there sort of a working relationship there?
Can I respond first to the observations made by Honorable Member Jigalan regarding the Department of Justice and its involvement in the judicial management process? And then I will come to the last point.
Okay.
The point which was made by the Honorable Member was that the understanding is that the Department of Justice was the one who was responsible for the process of judicial management, and therefore the clarification was needed as to whether was it only that the courts were the only people institution which was involved in judicial management, and if so, what was the role of the Department of Justice. I must say that the judicial management process has always been the court-driven process, but once the assets are under judicial management control, then the Department of Justice comes in through the master's office, because the assets of the company are then within the control or within the control of the master's office, within which that company that is under judicial management is situated. And as such, the Department of Justice role has always been limited to that. But as to whether the company goes into judicial management or not, it is the decision of the court as determined by the Companies Act of 1973. But as it was already pointed out by a number of honorable members, the problem with judicial management has always been it invariably leads to liquidation. And what happens is the same judicial manager who was tasked with the responsibility of rescuing the company will almost invariably become the liquidator. And as such, his main role will be to sell off the assets of the company and then pay the creditors accordingly. And what I must point out is that the role of the Department of Justice going forward, insofar as business rescue is concerned, will be limited to those business entities which are not companies, insofar as designing a model for those entities are concerned. But we are in constant negotiation with them, and we have been promised that they will have to align their legislation with the legislation that with the Companies Act as and when it is approved by Parliament. Therefore, since the Companies Act cannot be able to regulate any other entities over and above companies, I'm talking about partnerships, I'm talking about trusts, I'm talking about sole proprietorships, the business rescue in relation to those entities is still within the domain of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. As the committee may or may not be aware, way back in 2002, the Department of Justice came up with a proposed draft bill which was aimed at unifying insolvency and winding up provisions in one legislation and also dealing with business rescue. That bill was approved by Cabinet in March 2003, but the bill was halted because of a number of concerns from that time, and it had never seen the light of day, and it had to be taken back to the Department for reconsideration. And given the fact that this process is going to do away with it, it's going to repeal the Companies Act, it will be untenable to have a situation where you have the new Companies Act that does not address business rescue for companies. And that is why the Department of Trade and Industry saw the opportunity that in this case, insofar as judicial management is concerned, it would have to be dealt with under the Companies Act. Then we negotiated with the Department of Justice to the effect that insofar as business rescue concerning other entities are concerned, then they will be responsible for doing that, but in consultation with us, because we are consulting with them on an ongoing basis in this process. And we are hopeful that there wouldn't be any discrepancies, major discrepancies between this particular regime for companies and any regime that will be proposed at a later stage by the Department of Justice. Considering the fact that the Department of Justice will mainly be concerned with the unification of insolvency and winding up provisions in one legislation. And this will be a secondary objective of that reform. As it was pointed out, even at the time of the Law Commission in 2002. The last point raised by Honorable Member Chigarano related to the dissenting creditors, that insofar as he is concerned, he probably would like to know whether there is anything more that is granted to the creditors except buying out any dissenting creditor as a group.
What are the creditors?
Yes, what the bill provides is that where a business rescue plan is subjected to a vote, we know that the bill says that only creditors will be entitled to approve the business rescue plan. And it is possible that at the time when a vote is taken on the business rescue plan, certain creditors may object to the business rescue plan. And if the workers are of the view that such a dissension by a creditor against the business rescue is unreasonable and that the business rescue plan needs to be supported, the employees are given a right as a group to buy out any of those dissenting creditors. And remembering, of course, that workers are also creditors to an extent of their unpaid remuneration with voting rights, and therefore they are able to vote on the business rescue plan. And as such, they play a very crucial role. And the bill also provides that they should be consulted in the development of a business rescue plan by the supervisor. And the business rescue plan will actually determine as to how the company is going to trade itself out of its financial difficulties. Any relationship between what the bill proposes and the Competition Commission? I must point out that this is not really the domain of the Competition Commission. Although we have consulted with the Competition Commission on the implications of the law in relation to competition within South Africa. But the fact is, the Companies Act addresses principally different objectives from that which the Companies Act attempts to, or the Competition Act attempts to address. I mean, the Competition Act is looking at avoiding monopolies and either in the horizontal or vertical sense. And this is mainly the legislation that is aimed at rescuing businesses that have reached or are about to reach an insolvency state. And under such circumstances, it may not be necessary that there may be consolidation that will actually inhibit any kind of competition. But the commission that will be mainly responsible for ensuring compliance with this particular regime is the proposed Companies Commission in the Companies Bill. That will be the commission with which all resolutions have to be filed and with which notification has to be given regarding the consultation by the supervisor with all the stakeholders involved in the process for ensuring an effective business rescue.
Thank you, sir. Prof. Shurok. Chair, the decision of an interested party on whether to go liquidation or this route may depend on where they stand in the queue. For example, the receiver of revenue, I believe, is the first beneficiary of liquidation. And then, are there such things as preference shares which get priority payouts? You see, the employees might be at the bottom of the queue. And then they would say, we don't want to go liquidation because all the money will disappear by the time we get to our interest. Is there such a thing, and would that influence where interest would stand?
Farida? I'm just wanting, whilst I've agreed that this is quite a good piece of legislation in terms of Chapter 6, I'm just thinking of an example. When a company decides to liquidate itself, sometimes the shareholders transfer assets or assets to other names because they're planning long time ahead of time. It's not something that comes just offhand, okay? And then they transfer shares or any assets which the judiciary might be able to take it as a foreclosure to non-listed people that are non-listed members of the company. Now this happens in terms of the defaulters. I'm trying to think in terms of your first bullet that says that it is replacing judicial management. I want to try and understand if it's replacing judicial ethics for bituminous. If you can just explain me that. And then it says that the independent company can actually largely self-administer itself using an independent supervision within constraints set out in the chapter. I want to know what I will say. Come
on, cut me.
The follow-up on the question of Comrade Bantu about the involvement of the Competition Commission. It was a question not only related to the business rescue. The question was, actually about the whole bill. I haven't heard you talking about the measures in that regard.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just address those few remaining points. The first point, which was raised related to the creditors, whether the priority of creditors in relation to the liquidation is the same priority that will be adopted in a business rescue mechanism. We must understand that in an insolvency situation, the priority is that where the company has been liquidated, first in line are your secured creditors and your administration costs, including also your SARS and the liquidation fees, the liquidator's fees. And then you are followed by preference creditors. Preference creditors are basically your any outstanding amount in relation to the wages of the employees and any other statutorily required payments by the company. And then you follow the unsecured creditors. And then after your unsecured creditors, if they are all paid, which is unlikely that they will all be paid, they are usually paid certain cents in arrears, and not the entire amount. If they are all paid, then follows the shareholders. Then that is the priority of payment in relation to your liquidation. Insofar as business rescue is concerned, a different model has been proposed, and that model is that during a business rescue, the supervisor will be responsible for ensuring the undertaking of the business by the company, and that undertaking of the business could still be continued by management, but with the supervision of the supervisor. And one of the main considerations is that the company may be able to dispose any of the assets that may be under security, but the company has to pay the secured creditor any amount that may be outstanding from the loan that has been taken from that creditor as a result of the disposition of secured property. And the company, once it has commenced business rescue, post-commencement finance takes precedence over pre-commencement finance, and that is only in relation to unsecured creditors. In relation to unsecured creditors, post-commencement finance takes precedence over pre-commencement finance, and that the ongoing wages of the employees, if they remain unpaid after the commencement of business rescue, they are to be taken as post-commencement finance, and therefore they will take precedence over any pre-commencement finance of unsecured creditors of the company. In addition to that, the fees of the supervisor are only to be in line with any agreement that is entered into between the company and the supervisor. And we have been urged to consider any performance-driven compensation to the supervisor so that we can align the interests of the supervisor and the interests of the other affected parties in the transaction. That has not yet been included in the bill itself, but we are still considering whether such a payment model for the supervisor would be in the best interest of a business rescue regime. But all in all, the employees are actually given precedence in relation to the post-commencement finance so far as creditors that are offering credit after the commencement of business rescue. And as such, they are not to be put at the back of the queue as it is normally the case under your liquidation process. And the second question related to what if the shareholders during the time leading to the business rescue dispose of any assets to any unrelated or related parties who are unrelated to the company under such circumstances, what happens? The bill provides that any of the provisions relating to unlawful dispositions that apply in relation to insolvency actually apply during business rescue. And that is, the Insolvency Act provides that during a particular period of time leading to liquidation, if there are any dispositions that have been made by the shareholders of the company or the owners of the company, maybe mainly dispositions without value or dispositions without quid pro quo or dispositions without an equivalent value, then those can actually be clawed back by the company for the purposes of realization in selling those assets that may have been unlawfully disposed. And therefore, this bill provides that such unlawful disposition can be clawed back even during a business rescue model. And your second question, Honorable Member, related to the constraints set out in the chapter, and the company will likely self-administer the business rescue under the independent supervision with constraints set out in the chapter. There are a number of constraints that are set out in the chapter, and these basically include the constraints upon the management of the company. Actually, the management of the company is not at ease to run the company at will. For an example, where the company wants the company wants to take any post-commencement finance, that has to be done in consultation with the supervisor, who has to agree to the acquisition of such post-commencement finance. Where there is to be any sale of assets, particularly those that are subject to any security of any security holder of the company, then under such circumstances, the supervisor has to be consulted by the management, and therefore it cannot just be sold. And the manner in which the assets are to be assessed, that has to be done in line with the direction of the supervisor. Those are just few of the directions that the supervisor has to give. Basically, the supervisor has the veto over many of the business decisions that can be taken by the management, and within reason, of course. And it is a model that has been followed in a number of debtor-friendly jurisdictions, like in Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code of the United States, where the management still remains in force. And one other point that I wanted to mention also, while I'm still on this point, is that there is in South Africa a proposal, particularly from the banking fraternity, that the supervisor should not, the management should not continue to manage the company, because in most cases it will be management which has led to the financial, to the company's financial quagmire. And why should they continue to be in office when they are the people who have led to the company's predicament? Now, we do acknowledge that that is the case, but it's not always the case. In some cases that we have observed as the department in our research, we found that in some cases the financial distress of the company may not necessarily be because of the malperformance on behalf of the management. It may be because of the business deals that have turned sour, or because of the financial or the markets that have actually gone bad for the company. But it may not necessarily be because the management deliberately set out to put the position, the company in a position in which it finds itself. And under such circumstances, the department is of the view that it will be it will lead to an untenable situation where you require a supervisor to be able to take over the whole running of the company without the assistance of people who may have expertise in the way in which the company is run, particularly because we've got very limited pool of skills relating to the turnaround specialists in South Africa. And given the fact that there's a need for skills investment in that area, it is better to deal with it on a piecemeal level basis rather than to just introduce a system where a supervisor will just come and fire everybody and run the company at their own whim. And what has happened is that we have seen that with judicial managers, many of them have actually even increased the expenses that the company has to pay. Some of them use private jets to go between the meetings because they are obviously in control of the company. And under such circumstances, it will be something that will be very untenable. I mean, it has happened quite recently in a number of this judicial management judicial management processes. And therefore, it is important that someone with experience in the area of the business undertaking is there, and then the supervision is there to ensure that the constraints that the chapter imposes are actually complied with. The point which was raised in relation to the Competition Commission again was said that it's not only limited to this chapter, and it extends even beyond this chapter, particularly to deal with mergers and takeovers. We need to remember that the chapter dealing with mergers and takeovers under the Companies Act, the sole purpose is to ensure that the rights, particularly of minority shareholders, are actually taken care of and protected, and then the integrity of the market is maintained. And that in itself does not displace the role of the Competition Commission. The role of the Competition Commission will always stand, because the Competition Commission, we must remember that its role is mainly to ensure that anti-competitive measures and acquisitions in the interest of the economy, expansion of the economy, are not allowed to go ahead. And under such circumstances, approval of measures will still have to take place even at the Competition Commission stage, in line with the Competition Act, because this act actually does not address the same kind of principles that the Competition Act tries to address. And as such, the Competition Commission will work together with the Companies Commission and the Takeover Regulation Panel, which is currently the Securities Regulation Panel, in ensuring that there is a synergy between the processes undertaken by the Takeover Regulation Panel and those that are taken by the Competition Commission. But considering that from the Competition Act point of view, the approval is different from the Companies Act point of view here, the approval process is to ensure that there has been proper majority in approving any merger or a takeover in the under the Companies Act, and that such a process has been undertaken within the confines of the Companies Act, and mainly to ensure that the minority shareholders are protected. I hope that this, but if ever there's any more information that is required on the relationship between what the Commission does and what the Competition Commission does in terms of the Competition Act, and what this bill, what the impact of this bill will be on that, we can be able to provide a brief summary.
Thank you very much. Farida.
I just want to find out what would you suggest would be the credentials of a supervisor? Because the company would be very creative in your employing a supervisor. Perhaps I've missed that part of it. I'm not sure.
The bill, as it stands, does not provide for the qualifications of a supervisor, but it says that the supervisor must be a fit and a proper person. And that has been defined in law to be someone who has not been guilty of any dishonesty, who has not been, for example, as an attorney, been struck off the roll, as an accountant who has been struck off the roll of the accountant as well. And in addition to that, is that it says that the qualifications will be prescribed by way of regulation. Now, within the department, we have not yet decided as to what those qualifications should be, but as I've already said, during this workshop that we're going to have with the stakeholders, we will be stretching out our views as to what we think those qualifications should be and whether there should be any overarching or regulatory body that will be responsible for controlling or supervising the supervisors.
I would strongly urge us to look at a credential for a supervisor in the box. To define a supervisor.
In the belt.
The credentials. Because, I mean, a supervisor could be anybody. There isn't a limitation or a credential process. Because companies can be very creative and say, okay, in our view, this is a supervisor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairperson. Moving on to Chapter 7. Chapter 7 basically deals with remedies and enforcement. And what it attempts to do basically is to replace the current system of criminalizing almost all the provisions of the Companies Act to a system where alternative procedures or alternative measures for enforcement of the Companies Act can actually be implemented. For example, what it does is that it introduces procedures for addressing complaints or security rights, and these procedures are actually mainly addressed through the administrative actions that have to be taken to enforce the act, and these administrative decisions have to be taken by the commission, and the companies on board will be responsible for arbitration. And also it seeks to provide for shareholders to apply for a declaratory orders or the right application to declare or protect their rights. That is provided for in Section 162 of the bill, and that provides the shareholders with a remedy to apply to declare a director to be delinquent or under probation. And a director will be delinquent or under probation mainly if the director has been in the past been guilty of some dishonest participation in running businesses, for an example, or that the director may have breached any duty of the directors in relation to another company, in relation to or in line with Section 91, for an example, or the fiduciary duty or duty of care and skill. And in certain instances, the director may be declared to be under probation in the sense that the court may only limit the director's participation in management of the company in certain instances and not extend the person's participation in management. And it also provides for the relief from oppressive or prejudicial conduct, and that is in terms of Section 154. That is, if the shareholder can be able to go to court, and here we do not only say the shareholder, but we say any applicant who can prove that any conduct on behalf of the company or by the company has been oppressive or prejudicial to that particular person, then that person can be able to approach the court and the remedy can be granted by the court. And also the appraisal rights for dissenting shareholders. And these appraisal rights are provided for in terms of Section 165, and they are principally based on the U.S. laws that are provided for in the Model Business Corporations Act. And the bill also provides for shareholders of derivative actions in Section 166. A derivative action is an action that is taken by a member or an interested person on behalf of the company where a wrong has been committed against the company. And the remedy belongs to the company, in the sense that it is the company that is the proper plaintiff under normal circumstances. What that means is that if a director has committed a wrong against the company, and you are suing that director on behalf of the company, the remedy that is going to be granted by the court will be the remedy that belongs to the company. You have to prove that there was loss or damage that was caused to the company, and then that company has suffered loss or damage as a result of the wrong committed by the director, and therefore the court will give an appropriate relief to the company. But it's just that the company would not, under that many circumstances, take the matter to court, because as we are all aware, it is the directors of the company who have to take a decision whether a suit has to be instituted. And if they are the ones who are at the wrong, it's unlikely that the company will take any action against those directors. And that is why the company's bill is providing that certain other individuals except directors will be entitled to institute derivative action on behalf of the company. And the court may be able to allow such action, and the relief may be granted to the company. And the bill also establishes the process for alternative dispute resolution, which is provided for in Section 167, where the company's ombud plays quite a very crucial role. And also the accredited agencies, which will be accredited by the Commission for the Purposes of Alternative Dispute Resolution, will play a crucial role. And most importantly, the bill establishes an extended right of standing to commence an action on behalf of an aggrieved person, and a regime to protect whistleblowers who disclose irregularities or contraventions of the Act. And briefly, what the bill does under for the protection of whistleblowers is that it actually ensures that where there has been any confidential disclosure of the contraventions or irregularities concerning the Act, the rights of the whistleblowers are protected, in the sense that that person should not be subjected to any kind of mistreatment, including being fired from his position if he's an employee of the company, or being subjected to any kind of legal proceedings against that person just because they have provided information about irregularities or contraventions of the act. And this particular provision is actually in addition and not an alternative to what is currently provided under the Protectors Disclosures Act of 2000, which is the legislation under the auspices of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair, this section should be read together with chapters 8 and slide 38 as a whole, because it sets out the various agencies and then the whole question of decriminalization. I think it's all very good stuff, but one has a bit of concern that you're setting up a number of agencies which have quite a lot of responsibility, and not all agencies function very well. And indeed, in the end, we depend on the courts. So it is very important that Chapter 7 remains as an important fallback for where the agencies don't do their job. I mean, we have this gentleman from Cipro who gave us a sad story a while ago, but we do occasionally get sad stories from other agencies. Now, so what I'm getting at is this. I think that the DDI will have to be highly responsible to the proper provision of information to the public about all these procedures and mechanisms, so that small shareholders are protected, they know what, who is supposed to do what, where they can have recourse. So I think as we move to the end of this briefing, we really as a committee should place a huge onus on the DDI that as this proceeds, they must set out the full story about how small minority shareholders' rights are protected through information, so that they know exactly. You know, you're moving, as you say in the last slide, from you're moving towards administrative enforcement as opposed to criminal sanctions. That sounds very good, and we all favor that, I'm sure. But administrative enforcement is a tricky one. It depends on the administration. And if the administration is weak, you're leaving the ordinary shareholder to the mercy of the big boys. And so I would say that this committee should ask the DDI to say, we approve of the transfer from criminal to non-criminal, subject to the capacity of the DDI and the institutions which are being set up doing their job. And frankly, this committee has often expressed reservations on those issues. So, a caveat, please.
We're entitled to opinions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. We take that in good spirit, and we will definitely provide more information going towards the implementation of these agencies and the models that we are proposing. And I'm sure before the business model is submitted to Cabinet, it will probably be submitted to this committee to show the committee how the operations of the new agencies are going to be undertaken. Chapter 8 is basically the regulatory agencies and administration of the Act, and I have in the presentation from the beginning been talking about the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. I've been talking about the Takeover Regulation Panel. I've talked about the Financial Standards Reporting Council. and the company's ambit. And now the chapter 8 actually outlines what the composition of this agencies is going to be and what the role of these agencies are going to be, and also ensuring that in addition to independence, there should be proper enforcement of the provisions that are subjected to these agencies. In the first instance, what the Companies Bill attempts to do in Chapter 8 is to refine the current duties undertaken by the DCI together with CIPRO, and to combine those duties into one agency that is going to be called the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. Now, if you look at the model of the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, you will see that it resembles to a large extent the model of the South African Revenue Service as an autonomous organ of state that is headed by the company's commissioner, and in transitional measures there's a provision to the effect that the commissioner will be the person who at the time when the commission is established will be the chief executive officer of CIPRO. And in the main, what the model presents is that it intends that they should be implemented within the regulatory agencies for the enforcement of the Companies Act, a more effective agency that is going to be responsible for registration of companies, for registration of intellectual property rights, for enforcement of the Companies Act, particularly in relation to administrative actions, and also for the process of educating the directors, the shareholders, and all the stakeholders who are involved in the company. And in the main, the commissioner is going to be assisted by advisory committees. And the thinking within the department is that this advisory committee will basically be made up of components of different areas of administration with which this commission will be responsible for. For an example, insofar as registration is concerned, you will find the advisory committee there. Insofar as enforcement of the law, you will find advisory committees maybe dealing with the Companies Act, dealing with the intellectual property rights, dealing with cooperatives and all other entities that are regulated by the commission. And insofar as education, an advisory committee dealing with that, and also insofar as enforcement is concerned, you will find that there are increased measures of enforcement through the powers that are granted to investigators and inspectors that are given more explicit powers in terms of the Companies Bill to investigate matters or that are reported to the Companies Commission, and are also given the powers to search and seize and procure evidence from people who appear before them, as it is currently the case where the Minister of Trade and Industry has got the power in terms of the Companies Act to institute inspections and investigations, which could be proactive or as a result of a complaint that is lodged against a particular company. And that particular those particular powers are currently undertaken by the division within the Department of Trade and Industry called Office of Companies and Intellectual Property Enforcement, and which is mainly the division that is responsible for advising the minister on how to enforce the inspection and investigation rights that are granted to the minister in terms of the Companies Act. Those powers will actually be transferred to this commission, and the investigators and inspectors are given explicit rights for the enforcement of the act and to ensure that all administrative actions are effectively enforced. And as a result, there will be a merger between CIPRO and GTI functions that are undertaken by OCAP, Office of Companies and Intellectual Property Enforcement. The second regulatory agency which is proposed is the Takeover Regulation Panel. Now, the Takeover Regulation Panel, like the Commission, is not necessarily a new agency. It is basically the reformed Securities and Regulation Panel. Currently, under Section 440 of the Companies Act 1973, the Securities Regulation Panel undertakes the regulation of what we call affected transactions. Affected transactions are mainly your takeovers and your schemes of arrangements and related transactions. And as such, that body is going to be reformed in the sense that in addition to undertaking the current duties that they are undertaking of regulating fundamental transactions as provided for in Chapter 5, the number of the members who are appointed by the minister is reduced quite drastically so as to make it quite effective. And the Takeover Regulation Panel will no longer have the power on its own to pass the takeover rules without consultation with the minister. The takeover rules will basically become the regulations which will have to be passed with the consultation of the minister or with the approval of the minister, because there will no longer be self-standing or self-regulatory rules but will have the force of secondary law, and as a result they need executive approval. And I must say that one of the things which we considered when we went to cabinet was that we wanted to ensure that policy direction at the determination of the minister must be maintained at the level of the panel, even though the panel will largely be an autonomous entity which will have to undertake the process of regulating the fundamental transaction for the purpose of improving, maintaining the integrity in the takeover regulation, and also for the purpose of protecting the shareholders insofar as the approval of fundamental transactions are concerned. The third very important agency is the Financial and Standards Reporting Council. The slide says is the same. I'm sure that this committee was approached by the department sometime last year concerning the Corporate Laws Amendment Act, which has now been assented to by the President on the 17th of April this year. And in that Corporate Laws Amendment Act, a proposal was made that there should be the legal recognition of financial reporting standards, and this could be done through the appointment of an agency to be called the Financial Standards Reporting Council. Now, I must just take back the committee a little bit to what currently exists. Now, the committee needs to be aware that currently there is no legal recognition of financial reporting standards. This is done within the private domain, and this is done mainly through the initiative of SAICA, South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and the Johannesburg Securities Exchange, which in the 1970s created a body called Accounting Practices Board, Now, the Accounting Practices Board has been responsible for recommending generally generally accepted accounting practice standards as and when they are passed and distributed by the international body, the IASB, International Accounting Standards Board, which is based in London. Now, what has happened is that those standards have been made applicable through the listing requirements of the stock exchange. What that means is that those financial reporting standards basically have been made harmonious across listed companies, and therefore it has not been the requirement of any other company except those that are listed. The accounting Standards Practices Board has been held by the Accounting Standards Practices Committee, which is a committee that is set up within the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. The committee is mainly responsible for technical matters where the standards are issued by the international body. The committee is the one that disseminates such standards for consultation, and it consults with different stakeholders for the purposes of adoption of such standards in South Africa. And once they are adopted, then the APB then endorses those standards and they are adopted to listed companies. Now, the main aim here of the Financial Reporting Standards Council is to replace such private bodies with a more regulated organ of state in the form of Financial Reporting Standards Council, which will then be responsible for recognition of a financial reporting standards in a more general way for all companies that would be required to comply with internationally accepted financial reporting standards. Now, the bill provides that the role of this council will basically be to advise the minister on financial reporting standards, and that would be in the form of that is undertaken right now by the APB, which is then fed into the JSE listing requirements. But through this, then it will no longer be the process that it will go to the JSE listing requirements, but it will, those rules and standards as approved by the council in consultation with the minister will then be published by way of regulations, and then will be applicable across all those companies that are required to comply with internationally acceptable financial reporting standards.
Were you done with that particular point?
Yeah, on this particular point I'm done. I was about to go to the companies on that.
Just on this point, Chair. The auditors and accountants report to the Finance Committee in Parliament. And for years and years, there have been discussions between these bodies that draw up these codes and parliamentary committees. And clearly, parliamentary committees are very dissatisfied with the self-regulation that they constantly ask for. And this is an important move, and I would support it strongly, because the self-regulation has proved to be sometimes lacking, and the JSE has other interests to look after than the regulation of the public interest. And so I think this is very timely. Thank you, and excuse me, Chair.
Thank you, Prof.
Thank you very much. The last point, Mr. Chairperson, on this slide relates to the new body, which will be called the Companies Ombud. You will remember, Mr. Chairperson, that when we came with a discussion document in this committee in 2004, we were speaking of the Companies Tribunal, and you are probably asking yourself as to where it has gone to. During our consultation with stakeholders, particularly within government, on the advisability of the Companies Tribunal, we were made to understand that the way in which the department was proposing the tribunal to be constituted, it was probably going to be unconstitutional. And after our negotiations and consultation with the Department of Justice, we reneged from that that proposition that there should be the company's tribunal, because the judicial adjudication of any matter within the Republic is within the confines of the Constitution. And as such, the Constitution is very clear on the role of the court and the tribunal. And as such, the department came to a conclusion that the company's ambit will be the most appropriate manner in which the resolution of shareholder disputes, particularly alternative dispute resolution, can be undertaken without necessarily a judicial or adjudication of rights and responsibility as the courts do, and also the company's ambit working hand in glove with the accredited agencies that will be responsible for ADR, and also the company's ambit will act as a sifting process where the administrative decisions that are made by the company's commission will be subjected to the appeal processes within the company's ambit, and in that way then a less expensive and a more accessible form of appeal of administrative decisions could be undertaken without the need for the stakeholders to approach the court at all times, which is usually a disincentive because of the cost involved and the kind of processes and time constraints that are involved. Now, going forward, the...
I just wanted to make a suggestion. You know, I looked at, I was looking at the credentials on the bill itself. I think it's well spelled out. I was just wondering if you could look at page 309 of the bill. It's, perhaps if you could just think about it. In carrying out its functions, the companies of Ombudsman may have regard to international development in the company, in the field of company law, and consult any person, organization, or institution with regard to any matter. Perhaps you could tell me why you're using the word may, should be must, or what's the rationale behind that. And my suggestion, I looked at your definitions, you know, you don't have the definitions in your list of these things, like companies on bus. I think it would be a good idea to have the definition, because sometimes when these bills are so thick, and if a person wants to know a little bit about ombudsman, he or she should be able to pick it up in your definition. So I would suggest that we look at these headings and put them in the definition. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you, Chair. I think any measure that makes gives a means of redress to the ordinary members of the public without having to go to the expense of appointing lawyers is most welcome, because the legal law is out of the reach of ordinary people, and to fight big companies, you just don't stand a chance. So that's fine. What worries me a little bit, and I, you know, I might have got a bit lost in the 376 pages, is always the appointment of the ombudsman and the regulator and these appointments. Now, one of the big problems we have in this country is we talk about capacity, and a lot of people are appointed because they don't have the capacity, and we're battling with capacity. Now, if I look at, as far as I'm aware, if I look at the Financial Standards Council, and Section 204, the composition, fine, then it's, you know, four persons who are auditors that have those, you know, the experiences are set out. But we come to the ombudsman,
a lot of things seem to, I seem to pick up a lot of things that he mustn't be, you know, he mustn't be a crook and he mustn't be this, and, but it doesn't say what he should be, you know, and I will be quite honest, I'm very suspicious of giving the minister the right. We have complained, I mean, the public protector never seems to find against the authorities in this country. You know, you take somebody from maybe with the right connections and friendship, and then he's appointed to these positions. Where is it that decides to be that either, you know, you have to have A and B, you have to have 10 years experience, maybe as a judge or an auditor, or you have to have this? Because these are very important positions. You know, or a retired judge or a senior, you know, legal, you know, regional magistrate with 10 years experience, or, you know, maybe I've missed it in one or two places. I said sometimes you mention it under I think the regulation panel, there's recommendations from the exchanges, fine. But I don't think we've covered all of that. I might be wrong. But as I said, we put in disqualifications, but we don't put in qualifications. You know, and that's very important. And I think that should be very tightened up legislatively so that we have the right person for the job. Thank you. Thank you.
May I start with the question relating to why does the bill provide that the companies ombud may in deciding the matters refer to foreign comparable foreign international law and may consult with any relevant stakeholders, and why do we not use must? The term may in legislative interpretation does not necessarily mean may. It may mean may in certain instances, but must in other instances. This is because in legislative interpretation, it depends as to whether in a given situation there is any rationale for the particular official to consult foreign international law or to consult with any other relevant agencies. And if it is found that it was necessary that we should have done that upon review, then the relevant official must then do those things. And that is dependent on whether the issue under consideration is such that it is based on any comparable foreign legal principles, and under such circumstances it may will become must, and it will depend on the facts and situations of a particular matter. And I'm sure that in many instances we should not require people to just go ahead to go requiring or applying any foreign legal principles that they can lay their hands to without having thought about the relationship between what they are applying in front of them and what may necessarily be comparable under certain circumstances. And that is why it is quite enabling rather than compulsory. The definition of companies ombud, that is something that we will be considering. And I will be recommending to the drafting team that we consider including this definition in the definition section. If not in section 1, probably in section 8, which deals with regulatory agencies. The Honorable Member, Mr. Labuschagne, mentioned the issue of appointments and capacity, and that there is a need for us to consider, particularly in relation to the company's ombud, that there should be clarity on what qualifications should apply to those who are appointed to the company's ombud rather than who should not become the company's ombud, because of precarious circumstances that may arise in the appointment thereof. We will be considering this as the drafting team, and we'll see whether we cannot align this with other provisions that apply to commission and the takeover regulation kind of. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Now, chapter 9 is basically the chapter dealing with offenses and miscellaneous provisions. Now here, the chapter, in accordance with the objectives and goals, proposes to decriminalize company law where appropriate. And in line with this, the chapter contains a few remaining offenses, and those are the ones that arise out of the refusal to respond to a summons or to give evidence, or those that relate to perjury and similar matters relating to the administration of justice in terms of the act. And any such offences must be referred to the commission, must be referred by the commission to the National Public Prosecutor for trial in the magistrate court. Generally, the Act uses a system of administrative enforcement in place of criminal sanctions to ensure compliance with the Act. And the commission or the takeover regulation panel may receive complaints from any stakeholders or may initiate complaints itself. Therefore, the process is no longer the... It's no longer reactionary, but it's also proactive, in the sense that the commission and the takeover regulation panel will be able to will be given the power to initiate complaints. And following an investigation into a complaint, the commission or the panel may do any of the following things that are mentioned in this slide. And it is important to note that the commission may be able to bring a matter, even on behalf of the party, to any court within the Republic where it finds that it's necessary within the confines of the resources within government. And it may be able to refer the matter to another regulator if there's a possibility that the matter falls within their jurisdiction. For an example, where the matter falls within the jurisdiction of the Competition Commission, the Companies Commission will refer the matter to the Competition Commission rather than try to deal with it. And most importantly, the way in which the Commission will function will be through the issuance of compliance notices, but only in respect of a matter for which the Act does not provide a remedy in court. That is an administrative matter, more or less. And therefore, these compliance notices will be, if you like, for a better, for lack of a better term, the equivalent of court orders, but only in relation to administrative matters. And therefore, a compliance notice will probably be a very potent mechanism of the enforcement of the Act. And where there is a failure to comply with the compliance notice, the commission will be entitled to even approach the court, and such failure to comply with the compliance notice may be regarded as a contempt of court, and under such circumstances may be enforceable even through the court process. And therefore, the compliance order may be issued against a company or against an individual if the contravention of the Act was by that individual, or if the Act holds them equally liable with the company for the contravention. Now, what is important is that a person who has been issued a compliance notice may challenge it in court, but failing that, is obliged to satisfy the condition of the notice. If it fails to do so, the commission may either apply to the court for an administrative fine or refer the failure of the to the National Prosecuting Authority as an offense. In the case of a recidivist company that has failed to comply, been fined, and continues to contravene the Act, the commission may apply to the court for an order dissolving the company. And finally, in order to improve corporate accountability, the bill proposes that it will be an offense punishable by a fine or up to 10 years imprisonment for a director to sign or agree to a false or misleading financial statement or prospectus, or to be reckless in the conduct of the company's business. And in particular, this is taking forward what is currently Section 424 of the Companies Act relating to fraudulent undertaking of business by the directors of the company. Now on the substance, I think, of the bill, I think the summary is complete. What is left now is the proposed timetable, as we would like to present it to the committee. And this is how the department intends to continue with the process. That the updated version of the bill, following comments, will be prepared by the 31st of May. But this will be with the exclusion of Chapter 6. As we have already pointed out, that there's a workshop or conference that is scheduled for the 9th of June, which will then mean that the bill will be almost complete with the exception of Chapter 6 dealing with corporate rescue, which will then be completed after a proper consultation with the stakeholders on the 9th of June. And then the updated version of the entire bill will then be done throughout the month of July and then submitted to Cabinet around the 15th of August 2007, and also submitted to the state law advisors towards the end of August 2007. And the bill should be introduced in Parliament by early next year, 2008. And you will acknowledge that the bill provides in Section 227 that it will not come into operation before the expiry of 1 year after it has been assented to by the President. Therefore, it means that if it is introduced in Parliament in February and it happens to be passed during the 2008 parliamentary year and is assented to in 2008 by the President, then it will not come into force until 2009. That is in order to allow the Department to be able to set it out in order, particularly to set up all the regulatory agencies and to ensure that they are properly functioning and they are ready by the time that the Act becomes law, becomes effective. Those are my details. I realized that I did not bring my business cards, particularly because I ran out of them, but I thought it would be better to have a slide with my contact details for any of you who would like to contact me, particularly in relation to the issues that were raised in today's meeting and even in last week's meeting, regarding any follow-up from the committee, anything that you would like the department to consider. We would appreciate any correspondence to that effect. Thank you very much.
Thank you to you, sir. Massive information. Better placed here on the slide, business card. I see members, they wear different suits, you see, it might end up in one suit pocket. Unlike myself, who only has one suit. And the costumes and the various bangs. I'm told any self-respecting woman needs at least 34 of those bangs. Members, on the last chapter, if you'd like to share comments, we need to bear in mind that this exercise with the department was to walk us through the bill. We've been able to raise and flag quite a number of issues that we wanted. Obviously, they have a better insight as to our premier's understanding, and they will look at those issues. But as the timetable also indicates that, as the process evolves, we stay in touch with it. But we'll also, at an appropriate time, schedule for public hearings here in Parliament, where we would invite all stakeholders to come and have their say. This would obviously be after you have invited stakeholders and you've had the various workshops. and those members that can attend would have done so. So after that process, when we see we have made some progress, we'll call for public hearings, and then the stakeholders can come and interact with us, and also in that process, you'll also have a chance to state what the department's views are on that. Further comments, members, on chapter 9? Mr. Labuskagni?
No, Mr. Chair, I have no comments on chapter 9. I was just going to say, I think this has been an incredibly mammoth task. And the team, I'm impressed by the breadth of knowledge of that the team has acquired in its lengthy process, and I must congratulate them. And I think there's some really exciting initiatives.
Thank you, Mr.
Does that have me?
Not on this one, sir.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to go back to the initial. Go back to the initial.
Which is the new initial?
The initial one was the committee report on the PCI.
Oh, okay, that's before we take that comments on that report. If there are no further comments at this juncture, with all, this is the committee like to thank Mr. Mongalo and the other presenters that assisted him as we were walking through this bill, to say that the depth of knowledge and the professionalism is appreciated. It assists the members to come to grips on a number of issues. You obviously also have to appreciate that a member of parliament cannot be expected to be an expert in each and every discipline. Members, at the last count, are members of at least three portfolio committees. And each and every portfolio committee will pile its own issues on the respective members. So they try and do their best. So all of them would have various areas of expertise and experience, but not all of them are lawyers. There are two lawyers and some other people from different professions and understanding. So it becomes important to have the interaction with people who are on top of their various fields. So it does assist the process. We say that with the benefit of hindsight. We've also had other people to make presentations who are not always up to speed with what they are supposed to be doing. So it's another way of saying that the contribution of all the people who have assisted in regard to this, also expert in their absence, is greatly appreciated. So we'll continue interacting with you, and hopefully come to the conclusion of this process. Thanks. It's 12:15 now, and it normally says there's no free lunch, but there is a lunch. It won't be free. You would have worked for it. It should be here slightly before 12:30. So you are at liberty to do whatever you need to do, but do come back and join us for our paltry single lunch. Committee is very poor, but we try and be hospitable as much as possible. That doesn't have many. So, members, let us go back to that parliamentary, not parliamentary, DTI report.
Thank you, sir. The comment that I wanted to make around this report is that, in fact, it has to be noted that the report is of the portfolio of commission trade agreement. It's not the report of the department. I'm moving from that principle. And therefore, with all the, you know, what it is now, one appreciates, you know, the reflection of what the department was actually telling us, the input of the department to the end. But I think we would need to transform from this kind of report. You know, because you would only note that where the committee features, committee members, is at the end with comments, and it's a short paragraph like this. And to me, it really does not reflect the gist in that this report comes from the committee of parliament. So I would add that I don't know when, maybe in future, our report must really reflect the deliberation of the committee and the issues that we raised, and also the sites that the department, we know, was giving up that the work for the interaction from committee members. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Comrade Sassman. I just need to say the comments are well taken. I just to remind members that on that day I gave my report to the committee that I think it was the 14th of March. The department has come to report as to what they will do. And then when it comes to our report, I think on the same day, or the last time we dealt with a similar report, we have said that as members, we need to table the issues that we'd like to see in our report in Parliament. So as clearly stated, to have that aspect is lacking. So what I would like to suggest is that if members, between what today is Wednesday, between today and Friday, possibly, just to note the major issues that we'd like to go into such a report. So that different people, if there's more than one, we can write up those pages and then send them to the committee clerk, and then we'll, what's the correct word? We'll go through them and synthesize them into one report that can go with it. That would be my immediate response. But in order to do so, we also have to produce the one or two characters that you feel strongly about. There was another end, Comrade Jerome.
No.
Okay. Comrade Kassim?
That's your proposal for now. And with a proviso that, you know, it must not be diluted, or there must not be an ambush, you know, for members to raise issues that they must raise in that particular meeting. So that is very much important. But for the future, I would like the scribers, the committee section, and everyone to capture, because members cannot remember everything that was said in the meeting. So that's the point that I wanted to.
So now, I don't think everything is lost, Comrade Kassman. On the basis of your contribution, what is necessary is to go to the record of that particular meeting and then be able to incorporate the constructive criticism and the issues that were raised by members as well. So I will seek to get a copy of those minutes. And then, if it's possible, to stipulate that to members by today, so that if there's anything that we can incorporate from them, we do so.
I want to strongly support that, because I also noticed that
but I don't interpret it. That's
yeah.
A strong support. Thanks.
Fine. The direction is supported. We get a copy of the minutes. It will be circulated to you. And then if there's anything, please write to the committee clerk and I'll check on there that we get those responses and incorporate them into a report. Then the draft report will also be sent to you and say this is where we stand. How does it look? So that at our earliest meeting, next meeting, we can adopt that report. Is that clear, members?
Yes.
Thank you. Good folks, the humble lunch promise has arrived. And by the cheapest watch in the room, it's just 22 minutes time, not even half an hour. So please enjoy the lunch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all for having made our meeting a success. Thank you.